Listen.
I hate to think of people putting in all the work in the gym, potentially spending hours every single week, even potentially like turning down social events or leaving work early. Like, they're actually sacrificing some areas of their life to put into the gym, and then they're not fueling it. Mm-hmm. I'd hate that to be happening, and I hate that for myself. I put so much effort into the gym for it not to pay off and not to gain almost every little bit of muscle I could. I'd hate to see that happen.
Moin, and welcome to The Art of Personal Training. My name is Arne Otte, the host of the show, and I'm honored to have Steve Hall on the other end. And as you can hear, it's the first time I do this podcast in English, so bear with me if anything is a little bit awkward with something I have to say. I know Steve. If anybody don't know Steve, probably a few people, not many, I guess. Steve is a natural bodybuilder, an online coach at Revive Stronger, together with Pascal Flohr and Miguel Blacoute. Shout out to Pascal. He was on the show twice already. He's a podcaster too, the Revive Stronger podcast. And I would say Steve is someone who's doing an awesome job educating every sort of people with hypertrophy goals, while giving, I would say, a tremendous amount of context to every topic. Plus, I would consider him as one of the kings of hypertrophy analogies. That's a funny one. Steve, a warm welcome. And did I forget anything to mention, or what do you like to add about yourself?
No, I mean, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. And it's an honor to be the first English guest. Us English speakers are so awkward because then we just don't learn any other language. Language is always my worst subject at school. I can't even do different accents. I just end up turning into I just sound like I'm deranged. But I don't think you missed anything there. I am a podcaster like yourself, content provider, and really thank you for the kind words. And yeah, for the most part, online coaching is that's how we make a living. And yeah, part of a team with Pascal Flohr and Miguel Blacoute, who are both tremendous guys, and everything's just growing, and I'm super happy about that. And hopefully we'll be competing in natural bodybuilding at some point in the future again and do even better than last time. So it's a journey. I know you know that, and the audience probably do as well. So yeah, that's where I'm at.
Great. Probably you can give the listeners a little insight into your, I would say, gaining momentum over, let's say, the last 6 months. That's probably a good start to get into the topic of today.
Cool. No, for sure. So I competed in 2017, which seems like I guess it is quite a long time ago now, but it's just gone so fast. This 2018, just the years fly by now. So I finished my last show, I think was in September time, November time. September, I think, was the last shows where I didn't expect to be competing at that time. I thought I had finished earlier, but I managed to qualify for finals, which was pretty cool. I actually qualified, I think, for both finals. I qualified for the UK DFBA and the MPA, and I came third in both of my qualifiers. So for me to go and do finals and expect to do very well was kind of like, well, if either of these people who were better than me at those go and compete again and don't get worse, I have no chance really of doing particularly well. I couldn't really get leaner. You can't really get bigger. So it was just a case of kind of trying to I was eventually trying to eat into those shows a little bit. So I was kind of reverse dieting at that point. And I managed actually to come third in the MPA finals, British finals, and I came fifth in the UK DFBA finals. And the UK DFBA is kind of a more prestigious federation. I can't even speak English. And so I was super happy to come fifth in that. That is very competitive. So yeah, that's where I finished. So I was already reverse dieting into those. I don't really like reverse dieting outside of that context, kind of eating into shows, slowly eking away, creating a smaller deficit and maybe even getting into like a slight maintenance period when you're very lean can be great. Most people don't have the time. And the only reason I really had the time was because I qualified and I had those shows to go to that I didn't think otherwise. So then after the shows, I was actually in a very good position. A lot of people are in kind of like a bad relationship with food. They feel very fatigued, very run down. But because I'd already done that kind of reverse, I was actually feeling pretty good. I was on 3,000 calories and maintaining and being shredded at that point. So then I just went into like almost a normal off season. I'd say I regret the pace at which I left those shows. I went too slowly. I didn't treat it as a recovery diet, as many may know from 3DMJ. I literally took it as like an off-season kind of gaining phase and just gained it like a slow appropriate rate for me, rather than kind of double that rate, which is probably what is closer to recommended when you're recovering and trying to get body fat levels back. So I gained quite slowly out of the gates, and I don't think I felt very normal until quite a while after that. And I only really realized that in hindsight. I don't think many of us realize when we're competing how bad we truly feel, and we kind of ignore it to some extent and we think we feel fine. And then looking back, you're like, well, yeah, that some of those things I was doing were not normal, like still eating huge bowls of salad with every single meal, like after my shows and in gaining. It's just not a normal thing to really be doing. Whilst it might be healthy, it's just it's probably not a good relationship with food. So then, yeah, I did that kind of gaining phase for about 6 weeks after my competitions, where I was just doing like tons of training volume. I was just piling it on, and I could take it because I was in a pretty decent surplus, and I gained up, and I was sitting maybe, I only gained like 5 pounds at that point, which wasn't really enough to be over stage weight. I would prefer to have been like 10 pounds above, something along those lines. Then I took a maintenance phase. So I just drew back my training had got kind of out of hand in terms of training volume. Drew it back, and I purposely was doing stupid amounts of training volume. I was kind of making as much as I could out of that period of time as possible whilst I was in a decent surplus. Drew it back, went through a maintenance phase or a primer phase, I kind of call them, maintained that physique for about a month, and this was over the Christmas period. And then I basically started my off season from there. So I continued and did about 15 weeks of massing. And then I went through a very short mini cut. I think I literally did a 3 week mini cut. Yeah, I did a 3 week mini cut. And then I again did another 15 weeks of massing. And then I think I did a 4 or 5 week mini cut. And then I'm in my, I've just done 10 weeks of massing. And so I'm into my probably final 5 weeks of massing before I think about doing a bit of a maintenance phase where I'm probably at the peak of my kind of off season body composition, where if I got much fatter, I couldn't argue strongly that that was a good rationale, in that my, probably when we talk about partitioning ratios and how far away my body fat is from stage weight, from stage condition even, it might not make much sense to keep pushing. So I'll probably hold, and I'll probably be around 200 pounds. Mm-hmm. So for reference, my stage weight, it was carved up at around 165 to 168 pounds. So 200 pounds would be like a lot above that, over 30 pounds above that. And it will be by far the heaviest I've ever been. The heaviest I've had ever been before was 190 pounds. So I've already exceeded that, sitting around 195 now, which I hope I can get to up to the 200, because at the moment I'm eating like 4,000 calories and the scale really is kind of, it goes up and then it kind of just shoots right back down. I'm like, what the hell's going on? I'm just hoping I'm not holding on to like loads of water just because I'm eating a lot of carbohydrates and I have a fair amount of salt in my diet. So yeah, hopefully I get to the 200 pounds, go through a short primer phase again, maintenance period, lower training volumes, and then potentially enter a bit more of a moderate diet. So potentially go for about 6 to 8 weeks, not aggressive mini cutting, more moderate, bring down body fat levels to kind of a good low level where I'm at kind of maybe like beach lean. And then so I can enter a nice long off season again where I can incorporate mini cuts again and not have to go through a longer diet for a long period of time. And I'll keep cycling between this kind of massing for a long period of time, short, sharp mini cuts, massing, and then now and then entering into a primer phase and a short maintenance phase, and then a longer dieting period until I think I'm ready to compete and do what I want to do. And that is to be competitive in finals. Yeah. So I think competitive, I mean, I finished top three and top five. That's competitive, but I want to be like top three, guaranteed. Like trying to challenge for a win would be amazing, and winning my qualifiers, I'd love to be able to win qualifiers. I think that'd be really cool. But really, I just want to beat my last performance. And I already know I'll be able to do that, but I want to beat it by quite a significant degree because I compete in the middleweights and I have quite a bit of weight that I can push up. Like, mm-hmm. I think I've got like five, like some of the guys must have been, I can't remember what my weight category goes up to even, but some guys had like pounds upon pounds and it was very clear they had far more muscle than me. And I don't have fantastic muscle bellies everywhere. I do have a wide waist, so I need to bring up some areas to really make sure I'm competitive. So yeah, that's kind of a long story about where I've come from, where I am now, and where I want to go in future.
More than comprehensive. Crazy. Yeah. So you get it. Yeah. Very, 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 very interesting. What I think about when I think about where you started your journey, what you talked about, sounds like you are you was ready very, very early in your prep, and after that you told that you not gained the amount of weight you should possibly have gained, which would be a little bit more better. That sounds like at that point you was what I would call it, I don't think you was in fear of more body fat. And over the time you told your story, there was so the time you were gaining and your gaining rates go up and up and up and up till today. Is that right? Did I get it right, maybe?
So I think, yeah, I remember I've written an article on it called like adipose phobia, which yeah. is funny because some people wonder if that's a real word and I just completely made it up. Fat phobia.
Now it is.
Scared of gaining. Yeah, so now I've made it. I'd love to see that in the dictionary. That'd be amazing. If I go all the way back between I competed for the first time in 2014 and then competed again in 2017. That was a big time. Like, that's a long off season, longer than I even potentially have penciled in for this time round. But I didn't really let myself gain that much weight. I was very much along the lines of lean gains, gain as kind of minimal fat as possible, as if that was the goal. And build food as high as possible while maintaining as lean a physique as possible. I didn't really let my weight go above 180 pounds, mm-hmm. which, considering my stage weight is only 165, like 15 pounds above stage weight, that's still someone who's pretty damn lean. I think in my mind, I was fatter than I thought I was. I thought if I just train really hard and push this, then I can gain, which is really funny because I see arguments about kind of, oh, you can just maintain and you can do see muscle growth. And I don't think that's wrong. I just think it's so, so less optimal, so much slower, less dependable, because the actual progress I made between 2014 to 17 was nowhere near what I should have made, especially considering how well things are going now. It's kind of just even more highlighting the fact that I didn't make as much progress as I should have between those two shows. So I kind of learned my lesson there. And it has been a case of, I really got my training knowledge and my training together during my 2017 contest prep. So I think I even gained muscle kind of in the first few dieting phases there, because I really just had an understanding of what I was doing, which I think helped. But you're right in that after the show, I think I was definitely too lenient in terms of like letting it trickle in. And I probably at the time, I didn't think I was worried about gaining fat and concerned about that. But in hindsight, I think you're right. I wasn't as assertive, because I was just like, oh, if I just, like, I almost looked at the scale maintaining as if it was a good thing. Whereas at that point, it certainly isn't. Whereas now, as you can see, my mindset's kind of shifted. If I see a low weight and I'm like, no, this is not good. Exactly. I need this to be going up. And I think you have to be careful with it, because that is getting into the territory of just like folk mode, fat bulk mode, mm-hmm. which you don't want either, because you don't want to just enter a surplus and just focus on scale weight gain. But for people who have been on that side of adipose phobia, they've been worried about gaining the weight, I think focusing on making sure the scale is going up over time is a great thing, as long as everything else is in check. So I know my training is going really, really well and everything along those lines. I hate to think of people putting in all the work in the gym, potentially spending hours every single week, even potentially like turning down social events or leaving work early. Like, they're actually sacrificing some areas of their life to put into the gym, and then they're not fueling it. Mm-hmm. I'd hate that to be happening, and I hate that for myself. I put so much effort into the gym for it not to pay off and not to gain almost every little bit of muscle I could. I'd hate to see that happen. So yeah, my mindset has completely taken a bit of a complete somersault shift in that regard. And it's even reinforced by the fact of when you do mini cuts, you just see the scale come boom, right down. You see body fat levels, goof, they come right in, because fat loss is so much easier, especially for people who are traditionally a bit scared of gaining, because we are normally on the leaner side as an individual. So yeah, lots of lessons learned, and I'm really glad that I can share them with people, because I think it helps. I think there's a lot of people who have been similar to myself in that regard.
Yeah, perfect. That's what I hoped to hear from you, because that's what I think I see over the past years when I saw your journey, and it helped a lot of people, I guess, myself included, because I'm still one of the people that was on this lean gain train. I don't know what to call it. It's been a mind shift, as you said. And it's paying out a lot on your side, I guess, on my side. For the most listeners know it, I'm working with you now. You're now my coach, and So let's talk about gaining rates. A lot of people want to know the optimum gaining rate, the perfect rate in percent and in pounds and kgs, anything. What are your, I would say, recommendations, and probably how have they changed probably over the last year or so?
Yeah, awesome. So it's funny, because I years ago wrote an article about, I think it was, I compared Alan Aragon, Eric Helms, Lar McDonald and Mike Isratel on their recommendations for gaining rates. Mm-hmm. And basically they were very similar in many ways, but Mike was more assertive. So he was almost double the rate of, like, I think he was 2 pounds per month at the low end, up to like 4. I think he's changed his recommendations now. And then Eric and like Alan, for advanced individuals, it was like 1 pound at most per month. So I was always along, and I hadn't really heard of Mike at until, I don't know what year it was, but until like 2015, I hadn't really heard of Mike before that. So I was very much along the lines of, oh yeah, 3DMJ, kind of my source. I'll go with that 1 pound. And I think that held me back. And I prefer now to be a little bit more assertive than that. And I prefer to go for, personally, I like, and I don't know if other people have this recommendation. I don't know if there's any other kind of, what are they called? Like experts in the field, mm-hmm. who have this kind of recommendation as well. But I would say 0.5% to 1% every 2 weeks. So 1% to 2% every month, additional body weight of what you already weigh. So for a smaller kind of person, that might be like 1 pound to 2 pounds. For someone a bit larger, it might be 1.5 pounds to 3 pounds. So it's not, and that's a month. So that, I like the percentage, because it's kind of based upon how much the individual already weighs, and it makes sense. And I also like almost not individualizing it by training level. So previously, kind of 3DMJ and their rates of gain, and how I used to view it was, someone more novice would gain more quickly, someone more intermediate would gain a little bit slower, and so on and so forth. Because not even theoretically, we know as you get more advanced, there's diminishing returns in terms of how much muscle mass you can gain. However, it gets harder and harder to gain muscle mass as well. So the fact is, a surplus is always going to help with that. I always view a kind of gaining muscle like cycling uphill is very much a battle, and it gets steeper and steeper and steeper the more advanced you get. So I don't like the idea of reducing that surplus, making it even harder to potentially gain muscle. Now, you might have to have higher cost rates in terms of, you might proportionally gain more fat than muscle than as you get more advanced. But I think you get better at fat loss. I think that's a cost of doing business. It's just more expensive. The more advanced you get, if you want to continue building muscle, you have to expend more with fat gain at the same rate. And you might have to be a bit more fluctuations in terms of more intermittent mini cuts. And I just think that pulsatility is going to be superior to just trickling along, hoping that you're gaining muscle. I'd much prefer to be like, I'm going to gain a bit more assertively, absolutely make sure I'm capitalizing on every bit of muscle I could be gaining, rather than the other way around. This has a load of other additional benefits in terms of theoretically, a little bit more of a surplus. You should be able to recover from a little bit more volume. You've also potentially got the stress benefits in terms of like eating out, like meals out, and things are a little bit more easier, having that little bit more freedom with your food. And I've just found it to be, anecdotally with people I've coached, to be a far superior method than really trying to eke out the slowest rate, and with myself to be far superior to actually allow more advanced individuals, which often is the audience we're talking to and the people tuning into these sort of things and the people I'm working with, they're the ones who potentially hold themselves back by gaining so slowly that potentially they don't even know if they've gained. I know there was periods of time in my off season between 2014 to 17 where there'd be a month where I thought I'd gain like 2 pounds and then it would just fluctuate right down. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I feel like I've just wasted that time. And you probably haven't wasted it, but you can be sure you haven't capitalized on everything that you could have done. So that's kind of where I've come from and why I've kind of come to where I am now. I think for people who are more advanced to really go slowly, I can see their rationale. I just think they're probably kind of trading off a bit of muscle gain, and potentially they're in such a small surplus that they haven't got enough of a surplus to gain the muscle, but they've got enough of a surplus just to gain the fat, and they just end up gaining fat very slowly. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if that's necessarily true, and we don't think we've got anywhere near enough data on that, and I'm pretty sure they're doing a study at the moment, which is kind of investigating gaining rates. I think Renaissance Periodization have invested mm-hmm. in, I think it might be Brad and James Krieger and Helms, who are doing an investigation at the moment. So that'd be super interesting, because the only data we have, and the study everyone brings up, is based on, I can't remember exactly who it was by, but it was based upon people who were kind of doing other sports alongside their weight training. And it wasn't specifically towards kind of bodybuilders who were trying to gain as much muscle as possible. So I thought there was just a lack of specificity of that study. Like we know of many studies, there's kind of these small things that just don't apply to the population that you're talking to. So then you have to draw upon personal experience, anecdote, and also just theoretical mechanistic data potentially. So that's where I've kind of, yeah, come to. So in short, 0.5 to 1% every 2 weeks is where I like it. And I say 2 weeks because I don't really like looking on a week to week basis very often. So I could even say for a month, but I think adjustments every 2 weeks is as quick as you'd ever make them during a gaining phase, up to like every month. Just in case people are like, if I'm stalling after a week, do I change my calories? I'd say wait another week, then maybe make an adjustment. Because I think more frequent than that, you can just get into a bad position, which is also something I made an error in the past when I was trying to gain so slow. 1 week I might go up a pound, fluctuate, and then I'd cut back calories and then I'd come down like 3 pounds and I'd be like, oh gosh, this is just by having a bit more of a margin for error, having a bit more of a larger rate that you can gain at, and have loads of kind of room below that as well. It just let those fluctuations kind of just happen and not worry about them. So yeah, that's where I'm at. And I'd say final point on that is I don't like to just focus on the rate of gain in terms of, you might think, okay, Steve said 0.5 to 1%, but if your sleep is awful, if your training performance isn't great, if you are barely getting in very much volume, if you're really stressed, your food, your nutrient timing, your food quality, your protein intake's low, you better just be, be maintaining, because you ain't not gaining muscle. Whereas if you have all your ducks in a row, go for it. So it's always take that into consideration, and take into consideration how you're also looking. Is your body composition looking better each week? Or is it kind of looking like, oh, I might just be gaining fat. What's happening there? It's fine to have it as a rule of thumb, but we have to remember all these other kind of factors that are individual to like coaching contexts and individuals.
Perfect. Once again, pretty comprehensive, and yeah, sounds pretty logic, I guess, for most of the listeners, and I guess for most of the listeners who always striving for the optimal approach, and sometimes they're holding themselves back, as you said, they're spinning their wheels probably, but don't getting anywhere. And after a time, they get the fear of, I don't really know. If you can't measure anything, that's pretty everybody feeling are not pretty motivated by stuff like that. And so a little bit more gaining rates and a little bit more momentum, I would call, most of the time brings a measurable result, I would say. So, and on the other hand, to come to the next topic probably is if the gaining rates are getting probably out of hand or a little bit too much. Yeah, the big buzzword mini cuts are always there. So how do you see your recommendations or considerations when it comes to the ratio from higher gaining rates to the ratio of mini cuts? What are your which parameters would you take a look at?
Cool. So no, perfect, and that was a nice summary. So when I'm talking about mini cuts, just to let people know exactly how I see them anyway, because I think some people view them differently, but they're basically 3 to 6 week dieting period. So if it's over 6 weeks, I really don't view it as a mini cut anymore. That's become kind of a traditional just dieting phase, really. And less than 3 weeks, I think just there's a lot of water shifting in the first 2 weeks. You don't really know if you've lost much fat. But aggressive dieting periods, you basically want to get in and out of those times as quick as possible, losing the amount of fat that you're kind of aiming for as fast as you can. And the rationale is, like you said, if your body fat's maybe getting a little bit out of control, where that kind of partitioning ratio isn't where you want it to be. And when I'm saying partitioning ratio, I mean kind of where is the surplus going when you're eating? Is it going more towards muscle, more towards fat? And the kind of theory behind that is the fatter you get, the more that's probably being partitioned towards fat and the less that's being partitioned towards muscle. So for someone who is advanced, who's already in a bit of a poor position for the amount of muscle they can gain, they really want that in that their favor for the most part. And I know I don't think it's a huge deal in terms of kind of for a lot of people, our partitioning ratios will remain pretty good whilst we can remain lean. But if it's one small thing we can keep in our pocket to be slightly better, then that's awesome. Also considering just after a period of time massing, your appetite goes pretty poor. You don't really want to eat anymore. We're just talking off air how my appetite is kind of very low, and my girlfriend was Charlotte's reflecting on how like I just don't care for food anymore. We asked like, what are we gonna do for dinner? I'm just like, I just don't even care. Just give me something that fits, and I'll just eat it because I just need to get it in now. Which is kind of, in some ways, refreshing because in contest prep I'm so obsessed about everything tasting amazing, whereas now just everything just tastes pretty okay. So yeah, that can help kind of bring back that appetite, bring down body fat levels. But another way, and I don't think many people consider mini cuts and their ability where you can bring down training volume. So it's a nice period of time where you can bring down your training volume a little bit so that you can somewhat have a recovery from the high training volumes you've been doing. I think a lot of people don't consider that fact. And when you're using them, I think it's a great time to also get a little bit of that training volume reduced so you can somewhat resensitize. Not as much as you might with a primer phase, but you can somewhat get that refreshed. So you kind of, if there is such a thing as kind of the anabolic resistance, the adaptive resistance of kind of higher and higher volumes, your body has like a bit of a reset with these mini cuts, with the training, with your diet. So you're in a better position to then propel you forward coming out of it. So it's a strict, harsh dieting period. So you might be losing kind of 1 to 2% per week. Some people might not even want to go that aggressive. And if you don't want to go that aggressive, potentially mini cuts aren't for you. They are an extreme tool. They are for more advanced individuals who have a good kind of experience level with dieting and they've gone through these phases before and they can do it. If you're going through like a stressful period in your life or it's the first diet you're ever doing, a mini cut is not what you want to be doing. They aren't anything magic or special. They're just a nice tool to get you in and out and keep your kind of off season propelling forward. I personally have done 2 mini cuts so far in my off season since 2017. And I've had many people comment saying like, I didn't need to do them. I'm doing them too frequently. And to be quite honest, I'd say the proof's in the pudding. My off season couldn't really be going much better. And every time I've done them, I've also you question yourself whether it's the right call to make because things are going well. And every single time I come out, everything's feeling better. The pumps I get in the gym are better. My physique's looking better every single week. Every time, like after that first week where I'm back into a surplus, my physique's looking its all-time best. So they just seem to really kind of keep things, gaining phases, like keep them consistent. So after a while, you see the diminishing returns. You kind of have that clean wipe and the diminishing returns come back down, and you see a good consistent rate of gain again in terms of physique and progress there. So I do like them. I do think anecdotally they've worked really well, and I think they can help kind of with training fatigue and dieting, kind of put you in a better position to keep gaining. So if you are, like you said, and I'll get back to your question, which was kind of like ratios of how long to gain for before incorporating a mini cut, I think if you're in a normal off season period, I think a max minimum time gaining would be 10 weeks. That's very on the minimum side before you might enter a mini cut. I prefer 15 to 20 weeks generally for people. So that might be 3 to 4 mesocycles of gaining consistently before entering a mini cut, and then back into like a similar cycle of, it might be you do 20 to 25 weeks of gaining, short, sharp mini cut, and then you might do 15 weeks of gaining, short, sharp mini cut, 10 weeks of gaining, short, sharp mini cut. Because every time you mini cut, you're not getting back down to the previous body fat levels you were before. You're not also reducing the training fatigue like you were beforehand. You're getting less and less kind of payback from each mini cut. So there eventually become a time, like I'm getting to, where I'm going to hit my peak mass, I'm going to hold that, then I'm going to go for a traditional cut rather than keeping in just cycling and mini cuts. They do have diminishing returns in themselves. So something else you can consider, and something I have thought about, is incorporating kind of primer phases or maintenance periods with mini cuts. So you can almost get a little bit more resensitization and get the mini cut in so that you can keep the gaining phase then coming again. So that's something you can think about, and something I'm working with at the moment with a few people, where you kind of finish a mass phase, go through like 2 weeks of maintenance and then a short, sharp mini cut, and then get back into gaining. So that kind of allows you to, again, combine the kind of benefits of reducing training volume, reducing training fatigue, holding things, and then going on. So yeah, that's, I guess, where I come to with it. And this is where I've seen the best results with people. But yeah, you have to remember they're an advanced tool. They're nothing like massively special. They are kind of limited towards people who have a really good control over things, because training during that period of time isn't very fun, because each week fatigue just exponentially rises. So week one, you feel pretty good. Week two, you're like, wow, this is so much harder. And then week three, you're like, whoa, everything's getting so hard. Why is this so hard? It's just because you haven't got the nutrients coming in to recover, and your kind of maximal recoverable volume is coming right down. So yeah, that's, I could blab on for far too long, yeah. But that's how I tend to run mini cuts, and that's kind of the ratios, the reasons why, and my kind of feelings of how they've gone so far.
Perfect. But you always, you outline pretty good that you, nobody can mini cut and mass till forever. Yeah, that's,
people like to think they can.
Yeah, they think they can. They think they are the, I don't know what to call it in English, the snowflake that can do that, because they are much more smart and their body is other than everybody else. But that's what I thought myself 2 years ago. So that's good that you mentioned that. You mentioned that you're bringing down training volume during mini cuts, and you're bringing training volume down during maintenance phases. You call them primer phases. Yeah, I'm right. Yeah, primer phases.
Yep.
What is there any difference you can outline to those phases, both training volume wise?
No, yeah, perfect. Because I think a lot of people think that you can mini cut during a primer phase or during a maintenance phase. It's the same thing, really, when I talk about them. The only reason I call it a primer phase is because people hate going through them. So I try and say it's a primer, because it is literally priming you for future kind of training in the future, and priming you for any body composition changes you're making. Because a lot of people hate doing them. Even people who know that the benefits of them and know they're great, they hate doing them. So I love that I can coach people and take them through them, because I almost force them to do it. And then they're like, Steve, I'm so glad we did that. I wouldn't have done that on my own, which is really nice. So yeah, during a primer phase and a maintenance phase, volume is basically a fair bit lower than during a mini cut. So during a mini cut, what we're trying to do with training is maintain momentum. So we don't want to see a drop in momentum. As you said, momentum is super important for a gaining phase. We basically want to just hold it. So we don't want to see a performance drop. We don't want to see anything go particularly kind of like wrong during that phase. And if it is, then mini cuts are probably a little bit too aggressive for you, or you're going too aggressive for it. So I tend to bring volume down to around minimum effective volume for a mass phase during a mini cut, which is basically maintenance for the mini cut, in that because we're in a calorie deficit, our minimum effective volume kind of rises because we need that extra volume to maintain that muscle mass. So what used to be minimum effective volume during a mass is now actually maintenance volume during a mini cut. So that's where I tend to hold it there, and it just holds steady for the entire time rather than kind of working up towards MRV and things, because it's such a short period of time, it's not really necessary. If it was much longer, then you might want to think about kind of changing some things there. And then during a proper maintenance primer phase, volume's much, much lower. So it could be up to like almost, I think, like 1/3 of the typical training volume on average you've been doing during your massing phases, or like down 60% basically. So you're doing much, much less. And during those phases, I also increase intensity. Whereas in a mini cut, I just focus on kind of like more so the lower end of the hypertrophy spectrum in terms of rep to ranges. So that might be like 6 to 12. Whereas for the primer phase, you might be going down to like 5 sometimes, more so focusing on like 5 to 7 repetitions, big compound lifts. So you don't have to, like the big compound lifts almost make up for the fact that you're not doing like tricep work, bicep work. So you just do lots of sets of kind of rows and benches, but your volume's much lower in total than what it would have been when you're in a massing phase. And this really just allows you to really resensitize to a lot of the things that have been accumulating during your massing phase, because, or even in a cutting phase if you're coming in it from there, because what happens when we train with higher volumes for a longer period of time is we see a bit of a transition in our fiber type towards slow twitch, which are not the best in terms of for hypertrophy. Fast twitch muscle fibers are going to grow much more. Now, we want to hypertrophy our slow twitch muscle fibers, that's great, but if we transition so far towards that end, our actual ability to grow is kind of dampened a little bit. So by cycling back towards kind of heavier loads, more like powerlifting, almost like a strength phase, but not quite that intense, we actually see a transition back towards the slower twitch, and we see a load of training fatigue come down. So that's kind of the resensitization. Mm-hmm. When we talk about, and I don't have enough knowledge to talk about AMPK and
mTOR
and mm-hmm. things like this. I know they exist, and the theory is AMPK is kind of the catabolic marker that's rising as training volumes are coming up, and AMPK is coming down, mTOR is coming down. So then by refreshing, we kind of wipe the slate clean, AMPK is nice and low again, so that mTOR can kind of reign supreme. So all of these things are based on kind of theory and mechanistic data, and we're never going to have, I don't expect we're ever going to have bodybuilders who are going to have, give their time to do long training studies like this. So just through anecdote and through that theory, things are going super well with the people that I'm periodizing like this. So yeah, that's kind of the difference between maintenance phases / primer phases and mini cuts and the volumes used.
Sounds great. And just changing the word gives the people most of the time a better adherence or a better feeling about doing these phases. Like I guess, I don't know if you called it the same, like don't call it a deload, just call it like to get into a good position for your next metal cycle. It's like a preparation for the next metal cycle. It's not about the last one, it's about the future. That's a lot more motivational for a lot of people. I guess when there was a time where deloads coming into play, there was a time, the same like with maintenance phases are now, deloads was the time there where most of the people say, oh, okay, it sounds good, but I don't know. Now more people are going into maintenance phases. Now prime phases in your context or in your term, sounds pretty good. Practically, volume wise, would you say you keep the volume during a mesocycle when you maintain static or a little bit dynamic? What would your recommendations about that?
See, I just keep it static. I just progress through relative intensity and absolute intensity, tend to keep repetitions within a range and number of sets in terms of that volume. If we're talking about a number of hard sets as the marker for volume, because people argue kind of volume load and all these other things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, number of hard sets for the week stays static. Maintenance shouldn't really change in terms of maintenance volume. And normally it's a lot lower than what people think. And normally I end up programming more than some, slightly more than probably what people need to maintain just to satisfy their psychological need to be in the gym. And that probably goes for me as well. I probably do more than I need to, which is frustrating because you think for better results, I want to be doing as little as possible. But our psychology is kind of aggressive in that regard.
Pretty interesting because, yeah, I do the same for clients and for myself. Doing two sets for this exercise for, yeah, the whole phase. Yeah, but yeah, I think everybody will getting better and yeah, we'll be able to do less over time. And when we yeah, buy into that concept more and more, yeah, someday most of the people will do this low of volume, this one third that we probably know about.
Yeah, I think I was going to say with deloads, that's certainly my experience. I know the first time I was deloading, like I didn't really deload, whereas now I like almost do as little as I can during a deload. And actually, I enjoy it. I reflect on the things, like it gives me more time to focus on the business, do different podcasts, whatever it might be. I can go get my hair cut and not have to stress about time. So these sort of things. So I think you're right in that the next maintenance phase or primer phase I do, I actually think I'll change my training frequency to like 5 times a week or even 4 times per week so that I've got more time for those other things. And I think initially it's a bit uncomfortable, but then you get used to that number of rest days and you just make sure you're productive during that day. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that will help. And I think I might do that a little bit more with clients where I just reduce their training frequency. There is a trade-off for some people because they get into routine and they love that habit. But I think most people would benefit from that because that gives you a little bit of a psychological reset as well, where maybe training, like if you're doing 5-6 days per week, it just gets a bit much. So yeah, anyway.
All right, perfect. I got one other thing that I don't know what to call it. An observation I did over the last year with a lot of podcast guests. We came to the observation that a lot of a lot of individuals that are pretty huge today got sometimes or often one thing in common. They got a time span in their career where they had a lot more body fat and gaining a lot more strength than what we consider probably useful for today. That's an observation. Is there anything did you make the same observation when we look at the really huge guys in the natural scene that you say, well, that's a freak? A lot of people got those time span somewhere in their career, had that in their career.
Yeah, I absolutely have made the same observation. And it's interesting because I have thought about it as well. And I don't know what conclusion I've come to. I don't know if it was necessary or a good thing that they did that, or if it was just a case of they didn't know any better. Because for me, I gained after my accident, which is where I initially got into bodybuilding, I was out of hospital at like 135 pounds and I gained very quickly up to 190 pounds. So I probably regained some lost tissue because I was in hospital and sedentary and not eating anything basically. And then I started training like a madman and just pounding food back. So I got up to 190 pounds and I definitely was over fat at that point. I've never got to probably that same body fat percentage. But I see it the same. I know like Alberto Nunez, he's got quite like big before. Someone like Nathan Williams, who's like a crazy physique over in the UK. I think he's got like a little bit over fat before. And I wonder, and I think you'd have to ask them all, like, was that a case of kind of you knew what you were doing and that was productive training and it all went really well? Is that just a case if you didn't know any better and you're just like, quote unquote, old school bulking and it just happened? And then I don't even know if that's necessarily going to give you the answer of was it required or was it beneficial? Because it is interesting because I know, like, when you think about it, like, if you've got a bit more body fat on you, if you're a bit bigger, then you can probably move a little bit more weight, potentially create more mechanical tension, potentially recover from a little bit more volume. But I think there is also diminishing returns in terms of like what we talked about, P ratios. And there's also diminishing returns probably in just like how fit you are. And then maybe your volume comes down and you can't do so much, like number of hard sets. So it's an interesting thing. And I don't know if anyone's got, I think there probably is a bit of a sweet spot. And I think we're still trying to find it. And probably there's some genetic individual difference there, because I bet there's some guys who have just always been shredded and they just keep growing because they're annoying like that. And then there's people who might have to get even fatter than they'd like and make the best progress in, like Alberto says, kind of where you make your best progress isn't necessarily where you look your best. And there's probably a lot of people that have to get like that to see their best progress. I wonder if some people have to get like really quite fat to see the muscle gain they want to see. It's an interesting thought. I just don't know where we are yet with that.
Yeah, pretty interesting, because yeah, this observation comes to my mind since the last year or so. And yeah, the first thing that came into my mind was also that probably we will never know, and yeah, genetics plays a role. And yeah, it's always the bodybuilding, it's the marathon. And so yeah, maybe you gain a little bit more in that time, and over the long run, like 10 to 20 years, yeah, maybe it's the same gains, but slower. Yeah, you know, the ratio is another one. Like I always said, if you're keeping healthy and out of any out of any accidents in the gym, injured, don't get injured.
Yeah.
If that's the status you're in, yeah, you just have to tick the boxes and go into the gym and do your workouts and yeah, check the boxes, and over time you will grow. No matter what, that's the most important part. What would you say?
No, absolutely. I actually, and you've highlighted a massive thing that I forgot to mention. One of the benefits of the maintenance / primer phases is that although we deload and we see some recovery to set us up for future mesocycles, we don't see that we need more time than that to heal up things like connective tissue, to heal up things that have really been niggling us. We probably all had that like small niggle that's always kind of there. And then when you go through a maintenance phase or the primer phase and you come out of it, it's normally gone. And that's where these can be a big, big game changer for longevity. And like you said, it's absolutely true. Kind of the people who are the biggest, the best, are the people that are consistently progressing. And injury is sometimes what holds. I mean, you look at bodybuilders, and a lot of them do a lot of funny things because they're injured. Not many of them can continue to do the best training for their physique, like on paper, because they have to do things that are maybe they have to do because of injuries. So again, another reason maintenance and primer phases, it's hard because it's such a long-term mindset to have, and in the short term, they're not that fun. But it will be so beneficial. And if anyone thinks how like the game changer that deloads have been for them, it's just the same, but for even a longer time span.
Yeah, perfect. That's the outlook that I hope that this episode would give everybody. That gaining is part of this, because it's building, the body building. I always said to my clients, and if we don't build, why we are doing the sport anyway? And yeah, cutting is always there. Yeah, and competing is another thing. Not everybody have to do it. But that's another chapter of the sport. Perfect. I guess we covered a lot of ground on this topic, because yeah, it's not that easy for people to make a weight gain or gaining a weight sexy again, how it's called today. But I guess that helps a lot. So Steve, thank you very, very much. I guess, like I said, most of the listeners probably know your podcast, your Instagram account, which is awesome. But tell the people where they can find you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. Your English was great, by the way. The listeners will say the same. And yeah, if people want to reach me, Revive Stronger, basically on any handle is where I'm at. Revivestronger.com is our website. So if you're interested in kind of coaching or in the podcast or in any articles, Miguel's writing fantastic articles over there. We have a really cool one, depending on when this comes out. He's done one on GDAs, which is going to be coming out shortly. So that's going to be interesting to read. But yeah, if anyone wants to reach me, Revive Stronger on anything is basically where I'm at, or Steve Hall over on Facebook.
Perfect. I just can say, go over there, take a look, and you will be, get a lot of good content, as I said, with a lot of context. And yeah, thank you for your appearance. And I say goodbye to the listeners and see you or hear you on the next episode. Bye-bye.